Welcome to another episode of the Unmasked History of Scooby-Doo, the podcast where we delve into the mystery of Scooby-Doo media, getting clues from people who helped bring our favorite mystery-solving dog to life on various platforms, and maybe eating some Scooby snacks along the way. I'm your host, Alexa Lawler.
Scooby-Doo, where are you?
And it would have been mine if it hadn't been to those meddling kids.
Gang, we've just been handed our next mystery.
Blasted meddling kids.
Scooby-Doo!
Hello again. There's honestly just truly never enough time in a day, or a week, or a year to get all of the things that I would like to do done. But I'm super happy to be back putting this episode out. And this is truly a special one. This man doesn't really need an introduction. If you like Scooby-Doo and you know anything about him, you'll know who Bob Singer is. Bob Singer is an artist that has worked in numerous different roles in animation and has, of course, worked on a few different Scooby-Doo series, including, of course, the original Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? It was such a pleasure to be able to speak with Bob, and I'm so excited to share this interview with you. So, you know the drill. Let's just get right into it. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Bob.
I'm glad to be with you, Alexa. It's fun to talk about animation in general and Scooby in particular, or whatever you'd like to know, I'd be happy to tell you.
I have so many questions here for you, but I would love to start off, as I usually do with my interviews, with three questions of Scooby-Doo trivia, if you're up for it.
Sure.
For the first question, in what year did Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Premiere?
Well, it was broadcast in 1969, but we were working on it in September of 68. That's when we were starting to work on it.
For the second trivia question, which villain appears in the Scooby-Doo show episode, What a Shocking Ghost?
A Shocking Ghost? That was the electric monster?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the one I designed, yes. When I got the assignment to do the monster, I couldn't think of something to do that looked electric. So I went to a power station in Van Nuys, looked around all the equipment and pipes and stuff, and I couldn't get any inspiration. So I decided to just make a hulking monster type, you know, like this. And do something with ink and paint so that I, on the red character, they would put some, with a sponge, they would sponge on texture. And I asked the Nick Nichols, who was timing the show, to shoot it on ones instead of twos, which made it figure like this. And it worked. That with the music and the voice, it really worked. I was so happy that worked out.
That's so cool. The last question for the trivia. Which of the following three episodes is not an episode title from Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? We have Foul Play in Funland, Vampire Bats and Scaredy Cats, and A Night of Fright is No Delight.
I don't recognize any of those titles because they were probably done when Cosmo Ancelotti was reviving Scooby, the 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo. And I wasn't involved with any of those. I was only involved with the original Scooby run. It ran for several years, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. The answer to that one is Vampire Bats and Scaredy Cats. That was a Scooby-Doo show episode. To kick off the general questions, I'm curious, at what age did you start drawing? And did you always have a passion for it?
I still have the first drawing I ever did when I was 4 years old. And it was a boy and a girl by an apple tree. And I think he was holding an apple behind him. And he was looking very shy. And I tell these people, I say, this shows how early on I was very interested in girls. But in grammar school, I just did a funny face, and I showed it to the girl behind me, and she didn't think it was funny. So I kept drawing, trying to make her laugh, until finally I forgot all about her. I was just interested in drawing. But I used to draw every night at home, listening to the radio. And it's funny thing, the next morning I could look at my drawing, I could tell what was being said on the radio when I drew any particular line. That was a funny thing, that my memory was working pretty good. But I did a lot of posters for dances in high school. And then when I got to junior college in Ventura, I was doing a weekly cartoon for the Pirate Press, the newspaper. I have one particular cartoon I did that was a talk of the whole campus the next day when it was published. And it showed the nighttime with the moon on and by the beach with the water was glistening. There was a 36 Chevy from the back. You could see two heads together in the window. And the dialogue underneath said, "I will if you win the Oxnard game." I mean, that was a little bit close to being too off, but they printed it. I had fun with that.
What is your favorite thing to draw? And has that changed over the years?
Well, lately I've been getting a lot of mail from people all over the place. One, a little drawing or autograph. I find that I really enjoy drawing a picture of Pebbles. It's easy to draw and say, she's so cute. But one of the most fun I had was designing characters. And as far as, I do a lot of commission work. Here's a piece. This was my, the way I would use magic marker and pastel, like the ground and the sky is all pastel color. I have fun in my work. You know, I'm just so lucky to have been in animation where you draw pictures all day.
And what was your path to working in animation? Was that something that you had always pictured yourself doing or had wanted to do?
Well, after high school, I went to the Disney studio to try to get in. But I didn't have any kind of portfolio to show. I didn't make it. They only hired two people out of 200. So
wow.
I decided, well, I better go to art school instead. So I sort of forgot about animation for 3 or 4 years. Until when I was working after school, I was working in a advertising agency in Beverly Hills. And a friend of mine who is from school was working at this Seamus Culhane Studios in Hollywood. And he said, he called me up and said, "Bob, get over here with your portfolio. There's somebody just quit. They have an opening." So I took my art school portfolio over and showed it, and it wasn't very successful. You know, just a few illustration drawings and one painting. But in the end of the portfolio, I had thrown in some pictures, just torn, they weren't even mounted, of cartoon characters, like animals looking like people and things like that. And I got hired on the spot. And the man said, "Can you start Monday?" So my people at the agency understood and they wished me well. And I did start Monday as a background painter. There was no background paintings in my portfolio, But in those days, they had a system in the studios of hiring a talented student and training them on the job, which is really the best way to learn, is to get a job as an apprentice in a studio and just watch what everybody's doing and then pick up skills and learn more about cartoons. So that's how I got in the business in 1956.
And once you ended up at Hanna-Barbera, can you just briefly describe what your roles were when you got there and how that maybe changed over the years?
Yes, I had been working at Tower 12 with Chuck Jones, but I was not happy because they wanted me to be an assistant layout man, and I wanted to get into full-time layout, so I quit and went over to H&B, and they hired me. And the Johnny Quest show was being finished up. So I told her, hey, I paint backgrounds. And so they put me in the upstairs in the background department for 3 months. I worked on the last three Johnny Quest shows, painting backgrounds. Really loved doing that. And they had a lot of New York illustrators there to do the work because it was a very realistic show. And when the Quest show was finished, all these good illustrators who could draw this comic book stuff went back to either New York or they went to other studios because our studio didn't keep them on staff. So two or three of us were left high and dry when the Space Ghost and Dinoboy shows came in. We had trouble drawing that realistic style with Space Ghost and also the main characters. I mean, the incidental characters had to be designed. So luckily, if you know of Alex Toth, or Toth, however you say it, had just quit for some reason, and I took him out to lunch and I begged him to stay. Luckily, he did, because he did not only every week, he would do all the incidental characters on that show, plus backgrounds and all the props and airplanes and stuff. And that saved us. Meanwhile, the show was in trouble because of the deadline was not being met. You know, there's an assembly line in the studios, all studios, so that week to week, everybody has to complete their work. So Bill Hanna calls a meeting of me and Iwo Takamoto and someone else, trying to find out what was the trouble with we're not meeting deadlines on Space Ghost. So I was a very shy person, but for some reason I put my hand up. I said, there are too many backgrounds. I can do them for nine. There's 19 backgrounds in it. And I went back to my desk and Iwo came by and said, we want you to take over the show. So this shy person became a supervisor. And I said, okay, I'll do it. It's another challenge because I never told people what to do before. But we did catch up with the help of Alex Toth, and we got back on schedule. That was good for me, as for my career, to take over and be a supervisor. That was something new for me.
Can you speak a little bit to what that pipeline was? Like, when you got an assignment, how long would you have to work on it? Or what's the process there?
When we got a picture to do, they were 22 minutes long, and they would put two or three layout men on each picture, and I think we were supposed to do 16 a day, but I set myself the challenge of doing 13 scenes a day, because I worked fast, and as far as the assembly line, it starts with the writing and it goes into storyboard. I found out the storyboard people need to know, they need to have some sketches of the incidental characters and props and airplanes and vehicles to do the board. But in those days, each layout man did his own designs for his picture, and he'd go to the producer and show them. And when he got an okay, he would give them to the storyboard man. But the trouble is, when he began to do more than just three or four different shows, we began to get very busy, and soon we were doing 10, 12, 14 shows a week, each with 13 segments. So I went to Gene Barbera, who was a production manager. I said, we need to have a character design department to take the load off the layout men, because it would just slow things down. She said, go ahead, Bob, do it. So with me and one other guy, Curtis Kim, we started a department just doing that. And it didn't take long for us to build the staff up to about 15 people. All of them were taking drawings and making all these model sheets and pasting them up into sheets that were distributed to all the departments. And I was very happy that we were able to cope with all the production that came through. You know, we had to draw so fast in animation to meet the deadlines, so it was very sketchy. I think I had a drawing, a sketchy drawing I was going to show you if I could find it. But we learned how to do very quickly, because we all work from model sheets, so the characters all looked alike.
Can you describe the differences between the various types of drawings used in animation?
Well, I can tell you what we did when we got a script. We knew that the storyboard man needed something to draw in his storyboard, so we would do some rough drawings, go to the producer and say, what do you think of these? And he said, yeah, go ahead, use them. And we would copy them and give them to the storyboard man. Meanwhile, we had to make tight drawings of the characters and do turns, body turns. I would design my characters as a three-quarter view because it shows the volume of the character. Then you have to do a side and a back and a front view too, so that they could draw them easily. And then we would make Zara's copies and have people paste them into pages, 8.5 by 11 pages. We would send those copies of those to animation and to every other area of the studio, like background people, assistant animators, backgrounds, and whoever needed one, they got a model design. And then, of course, it would go get color keyed. There was another part of the models. They had to put color on the characters for the ink and paint department. And but as I said, there was a set time limit, and everything had to be done quickly. And we were able to handle 14 shows, although some of the shows had to be sent overseas to be done, because it was just quite a load for the studio. So Bill Hanna established a studio in Australia, and we sent work to the Far East to, I think, people in Czechoslovakia did work for us, and China and Japan and North Korea. And we would send people over to supervise to make sure the work was done on time and correctly. But the trouble was, a lot of work came back on film already, shot. And by the time it came back, there was no time to fix anything if there were mistakes. So a lot of work got on that was embarrassing to me anyway. They weren't done very well, but it had to be shown on TV because of the deadline. So that was a problem. In fact, you've heard about Scooby mistakes.
Yeah, of course.
They show a lot of the bad stuff, but for some reason, people love to look at that. It's really funny. no arms or no eyebrows or on the characters would come off all of a sudden. But it was a lot of fun to do. I sent them a letter explaining why those things happened, so they understood.
And that sounds like a lot of drawings, a lot of paper. Was there a set period of time that the studio would keep drawings for, or did they have a place to keep them? Did they get tossed?
You know, there's so much materials, backgrounds, layouts, model sheets. If you do so many shows after all these years, it could fill a warehouse. And there was a warehouse next to the building that we worked in. But the studio just couldn't pack them in anymore, so they began to just toss them, toss the work. It just disappeared. Although in some studios, there were people who dive into these trash bins and try to find used cells and other material and sell them to galleries. Anyway, Warner Brothers had a big problem with that, so they fixed it so that the material was either destroyed or actually given to galleries to sell directly. But there was a lot of material. There's just no way to store it. It's too bad.
Yeah, that's too bad. And did the individual artists ever try to preserve things that were getting tossed?
Yes. When the Johnny Quest picture was finished that I worked on, I went into the bins that where it was already shot and it was useless now, and I grabbed some of my backgrounds. And of course, I kept storyboards that I did. I did storyboards for 4 years at the studio before I retired, and I kept a bunch of those, the originals. Plus, I have some Alex Lovey boards. Alex was one of the best board men I've ever seen, and fast, left-handed. He could draw with either hand, actually. Some people can do that.
Are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm right-handed, yeah. My brother, one of my brothers, I had two brothers, was born left-handed. But my mother made him become a right-handed. And he told me years later that messed up his life.
Really?
To be right-handed when you're naturally a lefty, it does something with your brain. So I told him, you have to forgive Mom. She came out of Lithuania and she didn't know any better. One of my parents that I had from Russia and Lithuania.
And I'd like to talk about materials as well. Were you drawing on regular paper or is there special materials that you would use?
Well, we were just working on 8.5 by 11 computer paper that you use for everything. And the pencils were just, well, this is just a Blackwing pencil. That's what everybody uses. And it's got an eraser on the top, but it soon gets dirty and you can't use it. So we use needle rubber erasers to work with our work. It was very simple. And we had our light board and that was it. And of course, pictures to design backgrounds, you need to get some reference material. So I used to go to the Brand Library in Glendale, California, and do, because they had a lot of movie stills that we would rent. Or I'd go into Hollywood and go to the bookstores and find material. So it was very important that we got authentic looking backgrounds. We can't just dream this stuff up, you know. So we all did a lot of research.
Once all of the drawings were done, where did you take them or where did they go?
Well, we would, you know, you're doing a stack of scenes in folders about that high, maybe 100 scenes in a picture. And we would give it to a man named Bill Shippick, who was the production manager at the time, That included the backgrounds and the characters for the animator to look at, to animate. So I became head of layout on Scooby-Doo. So whenever we had about four or five layout men doing pictures, and I would go through each picture to make sure all the backgrounds were there and take a quick look at the drawings, everything. If everything seemed to look good for the animator, I would just take it in bulk and give it to an animation department. Nick Nichols was the head of animation then. So the assembly line had to go forward week to week. Because after us, it went to animation, then assistant animation, and the background went to the background department to be painted. Everything came together with the cells and the backgrounds in the camera. And then it was dubbing, and of course there had to be voice recordings. We had a recording studio in the studio, recording room. But much of the recording was done in Hollywood at the Glenn Glenn sound recording studio. But once in a while we see the voice actors come, like Jim Foray would come. Jonathan Winters came once. And the layout department was empty during a break, and there was nobody there. I found out everybody was out in the back parking lot, and Jonathan Winters was there giving his committee sticks, entertaining everybody. He was such a nice guy.
Do you have any other fun stories of interacting with voice actors like that?
We didn't really interact with them at all, except for Jonathan, because they were separate. They were doing the recording at night, and they would, because Joe had to be there when they recorded. But we would meet them socially sometimes. Very nice people and really talented people. Once at UPA Pictures, Judy Garland came by because we were doing Gay Paree, and she met the staff, and I met her and shook her hand. I was so amazed meeting her, I couldn't say a word. I just smiled.
Aww.
Were there any times where you had to step into any other kinds of roles that you maybe weren't credited for?
Well, after a while, I appointed somebody else to take over the layout department, and I became head of publicity, and I did a lot of work that was in the Hollywood Reporter and Variety. And some of the work, I didn't have my name on it, which I did. But and I did paint some backgrounds for some cartoons that we did. Jack and the Beanstalk with Gene Kelly. I painted some backgrounds on that, besides doing layout. And it was really interesting to do that. And of course, I was art director on Charlotte's Web that we did. We were very proud of that picture. Yeah. So I've done a lot of things. I've done storyboard, layout, background painting, and character design. All the four big areas of animation. And I'm doing a lot of tutoring young people who, some of them are overseas in England, who want to know about how to get into animation. And I look at their drawings and give them advice. So that's what I'm doing in my later years. I'm tutoring some students, and once in a while, I'll do a limited edition. When I left the studio and retired, they asked me to do some personal appearances at the Hanna-Barbera stores, which were still working. And I went all over the place doing personal appearances, which was something new for me to do, because I had to learn how to do that, speak to large groups without feeling self-conscious or too shy. But I began to enjoy it, meeting people. And they were so in love with our product. Even today, some 50-some years after Scooby. Scooby is probably more popular than Flintstones or Tom and Jerry, which those are still popular, but Scooby beat them all. People just love that show.
I wanted to talk about what the atmosphere was like in the Hanna-Barbera studio. Did you have good relationships with the staff, and would you get together socially, or was it more like strictly business?
Yes, a lot of us would go out to lunch together, the layout men. But for some reason, the animators, they all went by themselves. They didn't mix with us. I don't know why. I guess they were just close friends or something. But we had a lot of good friends in the studio. We all worked in little cubicles in a big room. And so there would be a lot of joking going on just to keep a light atmosphere. But mostly there's just a lot of people drawing on paper, and you could hear the rustling of the pencils. So because of deadlines, we just kept at our desks and worked all day. We had breaks in the morning and the afternoon. But yeah, we were very friendly. And we knew people from other studios. You know, layout men are like gypsies, so are animators. They go to what studio is busy. Then they get laid off, and they try to find work elsewhere. Then they get rehired after a few months for the next season. But luckily, at Hanna-Barbera, I didn't have to be laid off. I was there 27 years total.
And was that all straight through, or did you take any breaks?
No, I after 22 years, I felt I needed to change studios. So I got an offer from Marvel. Then I went to another studio called Sep Inter that was, they owned the Snorks and the Smurfs. And then I got a business of my own with two partners. And we illustrated books and did picture puzzles and for about a year and a half. But finally, I closed that down, and I went back to Hanna-Barbera for 4 more years. So actually 5, it was as a storyboard man. And then I retired at the age 66. But I took a lot of material home because I wanted to keep drawing. So I began doing limited editions for Ruth Clampett, who was representing the studio. And I picked up an agent there to help me. And that's when I began doing personal appearances, besides doing more commissions and limited editions. That's what I've been doing since I left. It was 20 some years later.
And what was the process of doing those limited editions? Did they give you a premise, or did you create something all on your own?
They did usually give me a premise, or I would come up with an idea and make a quick sketch and go over to them and say, what do you think of this? And they would have a meeting. There were several of them in a meeting, a commission of people to run that department of limited editions, and they would okay it. Then I would do a drawing, a really tight drawing of the limited, and give it to them, and they would put it into production. And it would be, they would make several hundred of them and sell them, give them to the stores or galleries. So I did that at the studio I did the first 12. They wanted one a month. And these had to be done, I guess I did them on staff. Yeah, on staff. Then when I left the studio, I continued doing that for the studio, but freelance. And I've done over close to 50 different limited editions all told.
I have a couple Scooby-specific questions since we haven't touched on him much yet. And I wanted to start with, when you first started working on Scooby-Doo, did you ever even imagine the impact that it would have and how your name and your work would be tied to Scooby for years to come?
No, that was a pleasant surprise, really. You know, when you're working, you just do the work, and then it's after a few months, it's on the air, and we don't hear any reaction from people. But when I began to do personal appearances, then I realized how much people love the show. And here we are 53 years later, or whatever it is, since it started. I'm just amazed it's so popular still. I used to tell people Scooby was more popular than Mickey Mouse now. And Mickey was known over the world, but so was Scooby. It was just a wonderful show to have a light ending at the when it was just the landlord or whoever was the bad guy. And there was some scary, but not too much. And the thing about Scooby was Shaggy and Scooby were both scared. And that's a different kind of a comedy team. There are other comedy teams like Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. One was straight and the other was funny. The Ken Spears and Joe Ruby really invented a new system that worked wonderfully with the dog and the guy both being scared. That was funny.
Did you work much directly with Ruby and Spears at all?
Not really. They would write. They were writers in those days. They wrote all these Scoobies. But they were so successful, and we got more Scoobies. Ruby and Spears began to have their own studio next door to ours. And I would do freelance work for them, designing characters for them, for their Scoobies, or whatever shows they had besides Scooby. So in that case, I would see them occasionally, but wasn't really close to them. They were wonderful guys. They were both of them very handsome young guys. And they really helped us a lot.
Do you have a favorite memory associated with Scooby-Doo?
Well, I remember when we first got the show in, Iwo Takamoto, who was head of layout and later became a vice president, he was given the assignment of drawing all the characters, the four kids and Scooby. And we used to ask him, we knew it was a load for him to do all these drawings. And we was asking him, do you want some help? And he said, no, I will do all these by myself. And so he did every single model sheet of each character and Scooby. Scooby alone had about 6 pages of poses. And, Scooby was tough to draw, big, a realistic dog. He was not a cartoony dog, really. He had to walk and move like a real dog. And he was on all fours all the time. But there was a storyboard man, who put Scooby on 2 feet because his story, I guess, required him to dress up as a woman or some other character or run. And I went to him and said, hey, he's not supposed to be on 2 feet. So I went to Nick Nichols, the head of animation, complained about it. And he said, Bob, it's too late. It's already in production. It went right through with nobody correcting it. So what I had to do is I had to make a new model sheet of Scooby in stand-up poses, running, standing, and being scared and all that. But it did open up new avenues of plot for Scooby to dress up and be funny with Shaggy doing other stuff. It was interesting how a mistake made a character change.
Really? I never knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Were there ever any villain designs or designs that you had worked on that never made it to an episode that you would have liked to have seen in an episode?
No, but we did have a small unit of 6 people who never got laid off and designed characters and backgrounds and stories for any new shows that were going to be made, produced. Joe would go back to New York with Iwo and present new show ideas. he would come back and we would have orders for a brand new show. Or some of the shows we worked on were not produced because it didn't sell. And so all of those drawings that were made were put into the archives somewhere on the shelf. And there's a very rich aura of the drawings that the public has never seen. You know, we used to work nights and weekends overtime to make the artwork because Joe had to take it all back to New York to sell, to show the network. So I was on that elite unit for 20 years or so. And it was very creative, creating characters and vehicles and artwork that would sell a show. That was really an interesting thing for me to do besides just being layout man.
Out of all of the Scooby-Doo series that you worked on, was the process similar for all of them, or did it ever differ?
No, we had a formula that we used all the time. They would try to solve a mystery and unmask the bad guy, who was somebody else. So that was a light ending. And there's always a humorous ending with Scooby and Shaggy just to finish the story. Because, you know, Scooby was invented because Fred Silverman at CBS got complaints from people that the cartoons were getting too violent. A lot of them were realistic shows, like this Johnny Quest show was very violent. So that's why Scooby was born, to sort of negate that kind of violence and have censors approve the scripts. Because there were a lot of people who would tell us, you can't do that in a cartoon, it's too violent. And the show was really copied after a couple of live action shows, like Isle of a Mystery was a show with some kids solving mysteries. And The Adventures of Dobie Gillis, I think, did that. But so that was how we were able to concoct new shows based on live action shows. Like the Flintstones were based on a live action show at The Honeymooners, I guess. So that's something that was done quite a bit.
Now, I have about two more questions for you here. This next one is, out of your long-spanning career, what would you say are your career highlights? What are your favorite things that you've done?
I think when I worked at UPA, working on Gay Paree and The Christmas Carol, Magoo's Christmas Carol, really fine productions. That was the first time doing feature length cartoons. But breaking into background and being hired at Warner Brothers was a highlight. I worked at the Warner Brothers main studio live action part on hour-long science films called the Bell Science Series. And they were doing three or four of those. But in between, while they were still being written, I was sent to the cartoon department and they said, put Bob to work until we need him. So they put me in the background department and I was put with in the room with another one who was drawing layouts and character designs, a man called Bob Gibbons. And as far as I know, he was just a nice, quiet guy who smoked a pipe that smelled so good while we worked. And all day we would play Frank Sinatra records on a machine. But we didn't talk much. But I didn't know until years later what a famous man he was, helped design Bugs Bunny. He was instrumental in that. But they taught me how to paint backgrounds over there at Warner Brothers. And I did paint, I think, 8 different ones with Foghorn Leghorn, Daffy Duck, and one with Bugs Bunny for Chuck Jones' unit. We had three units over there, and I had a wonderful 2.5 years there. Just loved it. Until I got a... my friend called me from UPA, said, get over here, bother, they need people. And I thought, well, okay. So I quit Warner's, went over to UPA for $50 a week more.
Lastly, why do you think that Scooby-Doo, a cartoon about a mystery-solving dog, has held up and is still beloved for over 50 years after its premiere?
I think it was the Scooby and Shaggy combination doing very funny stories, and the way Evo drew him as a halfway cartoony. Not, he was realistic, but he, you know, he was such a funny looking dog, and the soundtrack was good where he tried to speak, and but he couldn't quite make it. He had to sort of have a funny speech pattern where you could understand what he said, but it was not English, was something else. Dog speak, I guess you'd call it. But it's just a beloved character. Why was Mickey Mouse so popular all those years? It's just a character you love to look at him. He was so easily well drawn, and the stories were so cute. He, too, was all over the world very popular. And, of course, people ask also if they want Fred Flintstone and characters. And the Jetsons are very popular, and Tom and Jerry. Those four shows are still very, very popular with people. I've done a lot of drawings with those characters.
Thank you so, so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It was an honor and a pleasure.
Yes, I had fun with you, Alexa. Thank you. You're good questions.
Oh, thank you so much. And that concludes today's episode. Another huge, huge thank you to Bob Singer for taking the time to chat with me. For more Scooby content, be sure to check at UnmaskedSD on Twitter, or whatever it's called now, at UnmaskedSD Podcast on Instagram, or at UnmaskedSDPodcast.com. You can also find the podcast on Facebook under the Unmasked History of Scooby-Doo podcast. And you can now follow the podcast on TikTok at UnmaskedSD. If you liked this episode and want to hear more, also make sure to check those social media channels or the website. Or you can listen to older episodes wherever you like to get your podcast fix. Thanks for listening, and keep an ear out for the next episode.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo!